Good morning. You, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations. Why have you forgotten us completely? Why have you forsaken us these many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew as days of old. Days of old. My talk this morning would be about days of old. Some of you may not like this talk. Some of you may. Depends on whether you like history or not. And I love it, so you get to hear it. We just finished our two-week meeting, and it was really good. Really, really good. I came out of there renewed and regenerated and revived, if you will. And that's kind of what my talk is about. This underlying theme is revival. But it's the revival of the tribes of Israel, of Judah, and the kingdom there. So we had a couple of interesting topics during the two-week meeting. Rick Sparks talked about his survey of Revelation. It was really good. I think he needed probably two more weeks to finish it up to really do it well. But it was really good and kind of inspired me to go out. I went out and got Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon. I have to read that. I've always wanted to read that. I think I tried in the past, but even for me, it's kind of heavy, kind of dry. But I'm going through that because those are basically the kings of the Roman Empire. Just yesterday, I bought a book on the Plantagenet kings of England because I just love this stuff here. You got William the Conqueror and the Norman kings, and then Henry II Plantagenets, and then on to the Lancastrians. I love that stuff. So you might not. So, but you're going to hear it anyway. So I was talking with Charles Fry, and he gets the life of Paul, and I really love that lesson. It was very interesting to hear him walk through that. And during one of the breaks, I said, you know, you ought to do something on the kings of Israel. That would be a great talk to all the kings of Israel. You probably need a lot longer than 2 weeks. And he said, yeah, that'd be a good topic. I told him he'd have to skip Saul and David and Solomon because those guys alone would be 2 weeks each. And we always hear about those anyway. So you had to go to the next kings and talk about all the kings there and how that worked out and just their interaction with each other and stuff. So how many kings do you think there were? Anybody have a guess? All told. Good answer! I like that! You got ahead of me, but that was a good answer. Kelly said one, yes. So I'll jump to that and say there's only one king. Always was, always is, always will be, only one king of Israel. But in a temporal sense, how many do you think there are? I was kind of surprised because I thought there were more. I mean, this is a period of 500 years or something like that. And so there's 43 of them. And I really like them. I think I should memorize all of them. I thought, no, that's too many. But then I was thinking, we have our kids memorize 66 books in the Bible. I should be able to memorize 43 kings of Israel. But because they all have the same names and two different ones interrelating between Judah and Israel, it'd be really hard. So I said we should skip the first three, Saul and David and Solomon, but you can't because you have to talk about them to set up what happens afterwards. So this is my talk. It's like 12 pages. I'm not going to get nearly done with it. So I'm going to get as far as I can, and then you know what I'm going to talk about the next time I get up here. You get the rest of it, or maybe even the third time. So I said 2 weeks. Nah, I can't do it. All right. So the first king was who? He pauses. No, it was God. That's where you got ahead of me. So it was Saul. So Saul was the first king. And so people demanded a king, right? They had to have a king. They had these judges who rose up and helped them, and then they kind of faded away. And so it was the priest system. They were supposed to be governing the people, but they didn't like that. And they saw the people around them had these kings and everything, so they wanted a king, demanded to have a king. Not good. They had a king. They didn't realize that or didn't seem to like that arrangement with God as their king, so they demanded a king. So at first, so they got a king. Samuel went out there, and there was a king picked for them. Remember, they all marched in front of all the tribes, and they stopped Benjamin and said, okay, and so they went through Benjamin, stopped at the tribe, I can't remember the name of the tribe, and then they stopped at Saul. Of course, he wasn't there, he was hiding in the baggage. But Saul was picked as the king. So 1 Samuel 12. And when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. He's saying, you asked for a king, but the Lord your God was your king. So he says, now therefore stand and see this great thing which the Lord will do before your eyes. Is today not the wheat harvest? I will call to the Lord, and he will send thunder and rain, that you may perceive and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord in asking a king for yourself. So this is a good object lesson. There's a lot of object lessons. It's a good object lesson. So they've given a king. God gives them a king, but that's not what he wants. And he says it's a great wickedness. It's a sin that they have a king, a temporal king over themselves instead of God as their king. It's a sin, but he allows this to continue for his purposes. So the lesson is that just because we have things in the Old Testament that are there doesn't mean that God says they're okay. And I don't want to get into the topic of instrumental music, but everybody say, oh, they had instrumental music in the Old Testament. Yeah, well, they had kings in the Old Testament too, but God didn't want that. But he allowed it to happen for his purposes. So there are things in the Old Testament that are there that are not necessarily sanctioned by God. Just because they're there doesn't mean they're okay. So that's one of the lessons for us. So down in verses 24 and 25, still in 1 Samuel 12, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. And if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. So if you be obedient to the king and to me, you'll be fine. If not, you'll be swept away. And so I don't want to ruin the end of the story for you, but you've probably already read the book, so that's what happens. They get swept away in the end because they were not obedient. After centuries of disobedience, they were all swept away. So Saul was king of all Israel, both Israel and of Judah. Judah always been kind of separated out, but at this time they're really not separated, Israel and Judah. So then we had I've lost my train of thought here because I didn't write it down. Because I don't want to talk about all about Saul. So Saul was king, and then we had David and Goliath thing. Saul's embarrassed. David gets all of his glory and stuff, and so he's angry with him. But I need to back up because Saul was king, but he was only king for a while because he did something bad. He had a disobedience problem, or he had an obedience problem, whatever you want to say. He had an obedience problem. So he was made king, but he had made two fatal errors in doing that. One was he performed the functions of the priest, but he was not allowed to do so. And the other one was that he did not do as God commanded when he said, destroy this tribe, or this nation that I've sent you against. So because of that disobedience, he was unfit to lead. And so David was anointed king. And then for a long time, though, he was not king. You had the Goliath thing. You had the chasing David all over the country, trying to kill him for years thing, until the end. And then finally, of course, Saul gets defeated in battle against the Philistines. Three of his sons are killed. He's mortally wounded. And then he chooses what I like to call suicide by armor bearer. He tells his armor bearer to kill him so that the enemy will not. So David is anointed king. And he's king of all Israel and Judah, right? No. The answer is no, he is not. Because the commander of Saul's army, David is crowned only king of Judah, but the commander of Saul's army says, I don't like that. I can't remember his name right now. It's not Abner, it's the other guy. He goes and finds another son of Saul, Ishbosheth, there you go. That's for Mark. Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and they anoint him king of Israel. So the kingdom is divided. Here's the first division of the kingdom right away after Saul's death. But David is king. The kingdom is divided. 2 Samuel 3:1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And so after 2 years, a couple of rogues go in there and kill Ishbosheth in his sleep, cut off his head and bring it to David, expecting for him to be happy and be rewarded because now he can be king of all Israel and Judah. And of course, they didn't know David very well. They forgot about that whole guy who came and claimed to have killed Saul and what happened to him. So they got the same treatment. They were killed, but the kingdom was united again under David. Stayed that way for many years, many years. Of course, David was a good king, but he was flawed, right? He was human. He sinned, and he had great sin. There was adultery and murder. He sinned, but he's the greatest king because he repented of that sin, and he worked to try and make Israel and Judah obedient to God. He repented of that sin. You know, he said of David, he's a man after God's own heart because he realized he had done wrong. He repented of that. He tried to make up for that by being obedient for the rest of his life. So then he's died. He dies. Now we have Solomon. Solomon, the great Solomon. If you ask people who the wisest man in the world is, you'll get, or wisest man in history, you'll get many different answers. I mean, some people might say Hammurabi. He's the one who codified the Western law as we know it, the Code of Hammurabi. Some people will say some philosopher, Socrates or Plato or Confucius or whatever. But of course, Solomon's name will come up as being the wisest man that ever was. He was the richest man that maybe ever was, at least in the time of the kings of Israel. He was the richest man, he was the wisest man. But after a time, of course, the kingdom was divided again. And why was it divided? Always sin. Sin. Always sin. So I will be reading quite a bit, long sections of stuff, because I want you to hear God's words and not necessarily just my own. So just bear with me here. 1 Kings 11:1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, "You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn your hearts away after their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. Can you believe that? I can't actually believe that's in there. When you hear about Solomon, how great he is, and how wise he is, but yet I just can't believe that it's right here. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. He sinned and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing. Who had appeared to him twice. This wasn't a message from the prophets to Solomon saying, "This is what the Lord said." The Lord himself came to Solomon twice and said, "Do not do this. This is wrong. You will have to pay for it if you do." Who appeared to him twice and commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, "Because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servants. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days. For the sake of your father David, I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." So the kingdom will be split. Why? Because of Solomon. Here's a lesson here that I see in here. I call it the affairs of the heart. Your heart can betray you. Your heart can betray you if you let it. Okay? Solomon loved these other women. He said he loved these women. We're not talking about sexual immorality. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff in there. But this was, his heart betrayed him because he fell in love with foreign women. Yes, you can love other people. But the question is, should you? Should you? You have to be careful because your heart can betray you. Guard your heart and keep it close to God, and then it won't betray you. So when Solomon died, his son Rehoboam was made king. Jeroboam, servant of Solomon, had previously rebelled against the king. If you read the story, he had rebelled against the king and allied with other Syria or Assyria who were attacking him, and he had fled to Egypt to get away from Rehoboam. So now that Solomon's dead, Rehoboam goes to Shechem, and he's going to be made king. And so Jeroboam comes back. I remember the story. He comes back, and Israel is with him and behind him, and Rehoboam has Judah, and he says, "Your father's been pretty tough on us. I mean, he's not been very kind to us. He's ruled us with an iron fist. If you ease up on us, you know, treat us with respect and everything, then we will follow you, and you will be our king." So he said, "Give me 3 days to think about that." Went back, talked to his advisors. The older one said, "Yeah, it's a good plan. Let's start your reign and be magnanimous and, you know, be kind to them and show them mercy and we can build this kingdom back up again." But of course, the young hothead said, no, don't do that. Show them who's the boss here, right? Be even tougher on them. Just rule in fear and they will follow you because they will be afraid of you. So of course, Rehoboam listened to the young guys, came back, said, "No, not only will I not ease up on you, I'm going to make it even worse for you." They said, "Fine, then we won't follow you." So the kingdom is split. Jeroboam, Israel in the north, Rehoboam in the south. Jeroboam and Israel were evil. They were always evil. From the beginning, they were evil all the way through. And to your immense relief, I'm not going to talk about the kings of Israel. So, you can just go, at least we avoided that. So, 1 Kings 12, starting in verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord of Jerusalem, remember what Charles said, up there in the north, but they're coming south to go to Jerusalem, but it's on a plateau, so you always go up to Jerusalem. They go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their gods. Then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines on the high places, and made priests from every class of people who are not of the sons of Levi. Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he made. So he made offerings on the altar, which he made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, and so on. So he set up his own worship system in Israel. It was kind of like the worship system that they set up for God, but he had these two calves, and they did the same things on the same dates, and so it was this abomination, this mock system. It looks like the worshiping of God. They're worshiping God, but they're doing it in this different place where it was supposed to be, in a manner they were not supposed to do it, into these idols that they were not supposed to have. It makes me think of today, people take the Christians, the worship service as God commanded it, and they made it into their own. They made it into their own. Something convenient, something self-serving, and designed for their own purposes. And that's what Jeroboam did. It was designed to maintain his power and his position. It was not the worship that God had said to do. It looked like it, had a lot of the elements of it, but it was not what God said to do. And what did he call it? He said it was sin, that it was sin to do that. It was a sin for them to offer sacrifices when they weren't supposed to. So, Jeroboam, Israel, always evil. If you read through them at the start of all the passages about the king, on each king it said something like, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, or walked in the sins of his father, all the way through. Every single king of Israel was like that. So, they were doomed from the start because they refused to obey God the way God commanded it should be done. So, however, Rehoboam and Judah were faithful to the Lord, right? This is where you say no. No, they were not. You'd think they should because they split off and they were going to do it right. Nope. 1 Kings 14:21. And Rehoboam the son of Solomon reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, and Ammonitess. And Ammonitess, isn't that one of the people that the Israelites are not supposed to intermarry with? But did. His mother was an Ammonitess. Now Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins which they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places, sacred pillars, wooden images on every high hill, under every green tree, and they were also perverted persons in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. Just seems really odd that they had a chance now to worship correctly, but they saw what the Israelites were doing up north, they saw the other nations, and they said, well, let's do it like that. Again, we want to be like the other nations. Let's do it like them. So they did. They built these high places, and these high places, I'll talk a little bit about that more later, these high places get them in trouble every time. They always have these around. They just can't seem to get rid of them. And they build these groves dedicated and these pillars and stuff. So notice it says that Judah did these things. I don't know if it's relevant here, but I just want to point it out. It didn't say that Rehoboam did these things. It said that Judah did these things. So did he instigate them? I don't know. Certainly, he at least he didn't forbid them or control them. He didn't say, this is not the way it's supposed to be. He didn't govern them according to God's word. He let these things happen. If he didn't do it, he let them happen. He allowed them to happen. So another object lesson for us is that we need to guard our hearts. We need to guard our lives. Because if we allow these things to come in, then we'll have sin. We'll fall away from God. We need to guard our hearts, guard our lives so that we obey God's word and we worship him in the way that he says. So Rehoboam allowed sin to take over his country because he didn't fight against it. He didn't fight against it. So Rehoboam dies, and his son Abijam reigns in his place. Now he's going to be good, right? No? Okay. 1 Kings 15, 1 through 3. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, because whenever they have the Bible, they're always relating one king to the other king. So, talking about King Jeroboam, well, in his 18th year, Abijah became king over Judah. He reigned 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the granddaughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins of his father, which he had done before him. His heart was not loyal to the Lord his God. So this is not good, not a good start. Not a good start for Judah. They're supposed to be the good kingdom, but they didn't start off well. They're supposed to be special, set apart, sanctified for the Lord, but they're sinning. They're doing it. Difference is that Israel will continue to do evil. All the kings are evil, but Judah is going to have some periods of revival here. And this is kind of like the underlying topic I was talking about. They will have periods of revival where a king will come up and he will say, this isn't right. He will bring the people back. He will start worshiping the way they're supposed to. And everything is good until it's not good and they fall away again. There were kind of three main revival periods. One, the first one was kind of small, but the next two were big. It's like a pattern where they sin down and then they get somebody to come up and they go up again and they come down and sink even lower. And somebody comes back again and they come down, and up and down like that till the end, till they go all the way down to the end. It seems like those good kings were really, really good kings, but maybe it's just because the people had gotten so really, really bad that in comparison they looked really good. So those kings, Asa was one. Of course, I always like that name because I had a relative named Asa. Hezekiah and Josiah. Those are the three that we're going to talk about. I'm going to focus on those, but we'll have to walk through the others as I do. So, the Old Testament is here to teach us what we know. That's why we have all these historical things. It's kind of boring to some people and go, oh, why do we have this, all these kings and stuff? You know, it's repetitive over and over. He did evil, he did good, he did evil, he did good. It's there to teach us what happens when these things go on, when evil comes in or when good comes in. It's to guide us in our future, to demonstrate the consequences of doing stuff or of not doing stuff. That's the whole purpose of it. So now I'm to the first good king and I'm out of time. So if I hadn't talked very much, we could get further. So in my next talk, you will hear about Asa and Jehoshaphat, his son. I'm going to link those together because those are the first of the two good kings where they say, this is not right. We're going to turn back to God. We're going to turn back to God. So at work, so I'm going to close here on the historical part of it and we'll do some more the next time I talk. So when at work, sometimes we have problems that are going on and we're trying to install a new billing system, just off topic here, but I'm going to bring it back. We're off topic here. We have tried to install a new billing system and a new commercial policy system, and it's like it's going to be $350 to $400 million to bring this in there. And they just don't realize it, what's going on. We finally get people to understand the gravity or the complexity of these things. And there's a term they use at work, and I don't like it, because I don't think it's wrong. They say, oh, we have a come-to-Jesus moment. Oh, this is a come-to-Jesus moment where you just got to grapple with the reality of your situation and make some hard decisions. Well, now, right now, this is truly a come-to-Jesus moment where you have to take a look at your situation, grapple with the reality of it, and make some hard decisions. This is the come-to-Jesus moment. We're offering it. It's always open, but we offer it now to point it out and make it clear that if you haven't come to Jesus, you have to, or you're going to be like the kings of Israel and these people who do evil in the sight of the Lord, and they paid for it. We'll don't pay for it now with some kingdom conquering you, but you'll pay for it later. So we're offering the come to Jesus moment. If you haven't been baptized, I talked to Larry. He said it's all cleaned up after the hard use it got over the 2-week meeting, which was great, but now it's all clean, sparkling, ready to go. Be the first. Be the first. We're going to offer the gospel invitation as we stand and sing. Make Jesus your Savior.